What's up?
What's up?
How are you, dude?
I'm good. Did you
How the heck
say
is
you
work?
use you've been using Anchor? Have you been listening to the super satisfying hold music that they have when you wait for somebody to sign on?
Well, so far my experience with Anchor has been very lonely because I do a podcast that I haven't announced yet and I do it by myself. So it's just me talking to Anchor by myself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we don't need any more by ourselves right now.
Yeah, getting plenty of that.
Yeah, no kidding. Do you have Kristen at home too? So the two of you just chilling together?
Yeah, so she's a nurse. Is this on the show or no?
Yeah, we'll just go ahead and start. I figure, episode one, we're just winging it.
We're just winging it,
We're just
man.
winging it.
So my wife is a nurse and she's helping out with the pandemic here in our area. It's crazy actually from that perspective to see how that works. It's been extremely competitive. It's a really funny thing because they've got hospitals being like, we need more nurses, and then nurses being like, how about more money?
Yeah.
And so it's
How about money for risking our life?
it's a bidding war, and she was able to secure a really good situation.
That's
I can't
awesome.
I'm not allowed to share the numbers, but it's crazy.
Yeah, that's cool. She's in a fortunate position, but she's in a fortunate position because of how hard she worked, and that's good. If you guys did not know from when you clicked on this, I'm talking to my longtime buddy, and super producer and all around nice guy, Joey Sturgis,
Thanks, man.
from our houses,
Yeah,
because we're not allowed to go anywhere.
we're practicing social distancing through
Yeah,
the internet.
yeah. I did one of these with Davey the other day, which was cool. I did one of
Nice.
these with a gentleman in Australia yesterday. I'm pretty much taking any opportunity just to talk to people at this point.
I've noticed that podcasts have really picked up. In the last 7 days, actually, okay, in the last year, I've done maybe one or two podcasts. In the last 7 days, I've done about six.
Yeah. I've been listening to him like crazy. Whenever I have time at home anyway. I kind of think my time off the road is sort of like quarantine every time. I travel so much, and I have traveled for so long that I'm actually more settled in on a tour, which sounds crazy, but when I come home, I feel like I'm sort of restarting every time. So I
Yeah.
find myself listening to a lot of podcasts from friends of ours just so I can feel like I have like a little bit of relation to the community when I'm separated from the music world. So this was like a natural direction to go, I think, for everybody, because now all of a sudden it's like everybody on earth is sort of missing hanging out with people, not just me, while I sit in my room like a weirdo.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I think, now more than ever is an important time period to really evaluate how people use their time. And one of the things that I'm sort of, fighting for is education. And obviously for my own, selfish ways, because I am an educator and I want to educate more people and I want more people to be educated. But think about it, man. Like, if you don't have the option to go and run errands or go outside and do all these things and get caught up in all these distracting activities, then what else could you do? Like, might as well get smarter,
Yeah.
acquire more skills and get to the point where now when we come out of this recession and we come out of this whole thing, you'll have something new in your pocket that you can use for the rest of your life. And so I think a really good use of time indoors, especially when it's required, is to educate yourself on whatever it is that you want to learn.
Yeah, you know what I've been learning the last year that surprised me is how many of our touring friends are graduating from college right now. How many of them have been putting the time in behind the scenes and on the road full time and making records full time. And then they ask, you know, they have this whole second goal set that they've been working on, and now they're graduating school and starting these other things. It's pretty crazy. That's just another one of those time is just flying by things, though. That it's amazing how long a college degree actually takes, but how fast it goes by when you didn't know somebody was doing it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I never went to college, and so it's weird for me to even think about it and talk about it, because like I don't even know how what it's like. I don't.
Same. And I don't have very many. I don't have very much experience with friends who lived the like on campus traditional life either. I really have no idea what that's like. I've had one very specific lifestyle for like 12 years now. So I'm always so, I don't know if mesmerized is the right word, but I guess interested would probably be a better word. I'm always really interested in what people are doing that's not what I'm doing, considering it's still the only thing that I've done.
Yeah. I would say nowadays it is one of the first time periods where you don't necessarily need the public school. Like you don't need,
yeah.
It's kind of crazy. Like my wife even grew up homeschooled, and even me, like I went to high school, and the last 2 years of my high school, I really wasn't even there that much because they had these different programs and I was in them. And then I got like job placement and stuff. So I like pretty much would go to school from like 8 a.m. or whatever time school starts till like noon. And then I would go have lunch and then go to work. And then I would work until like 5 or 6 and then go home. So I don't know, man, I just learned online. Like I think if you have a passion for something, the internet has now made it possible to basically turn whatever that is into a money generating prospect. I mean, and if you're interested enough to go down a rabbit hole, search up enough information and teach yourself how things work, then you just don't need a professor. You don't need a classroom, as long as you're, you know, diligent and willing to actually focus. I know that's not everybody though. So some people need that structured environment.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of it's the experience too. I know that that's like a, you know, I'm sure if you went to university and lived there and stuff, you'll be looking back on that the rest of, hopefully fondly, hopefully it just wasn't a shit time and you were, and now you're just looking back at it like, well, that was not the best 4 years, but we got through it. But yeah, I think that's another thing is you'll be looking back on it. Like you'll have a whole different like set of friends for your life that you'll like run into throughout the rest of your life on occasion. Just like I guess high school's like that, you know, you, you're a year older than me. I think it, my 10-year thing already passed. So it's like, I remember when I graduated in 06, I was thinking to myself like, man, that 10-year, that's so far away. It'll be so crazy. And now I think I'm at like 15 or something. So, and I didn't go to the reunion, but I'll run into people from high school and stuff. And I'm like, I can only imagine what that's going to be like when I'm 50 and I'm running into people and I'm like, dude, digging deep to remember what our interactions would have been 30 years ago.
Exactly. It's actually very bizarre. Like, I stayed in my town for a while after graduating. I was there for like, let's say, how long was that? I don't know.
I graduated in 06 and I don't think I left until 2011, maybe. And actually, I don't think I left town until 2014. Like, I've got my own place, but I still...
So you did it faster than me. I graduated in 2003, and I left in 2011. But, so, when you stay in your hometown, I don't know, maybe you have sort of this, like, idea of, like, who the cool kids are and where the rich area is. And you, like, think about... You have, like, all these different ideas in your head. And then you leave your town, and you grow your life. And then... for me, like, I didn't go back to Connersville very often. I mean, there was time periods where, like, for 4 years, I wouldn't go back. But then you go back, and then you're like, holy crap, like, and I don't mean to sound like, you know, like I have a complex or an ego or anything, but I kind of come back, like, as the king, because I see people I went to high school with, and they still work at McDonald's. And,
yeah.
And I just, like, it's so weird, because I remember when I left, I still had those ideals. I still had, like...
Yeah, man. Connersville's an, like, interesting place, too. It's so small.
It really is a black hole of the earth.
I mean, we grew up in really similar situations. We've talked about that before. I grew up in Springfield, which is a shitty, out of money version of, like, Dayton in sections. Like, some sections it's worse than the major city that's close to it, and then some sections there's, like, this beautiful little rich community, and then other sections there's a, but overall, I mean, it's only like 50,000 people, and the mall has one store in it now, so, you know, like, there's no communal hangout spot or anything. It's a weird place like that too. And then I moved to Columbus. I didn't even leave the state. And I think of all of the things I haven't done, which is funny because I travel so much that I would care about this, I still care a lot that I have not moved away. And that's one for me that I'm like, you should probably give that a go. Like, you're brave enough to travel all year and have been like that for almost 12 years, 13 years now, but you won't move out of this state. I complain about the weather every year and how I get bored and I don't have the right connections when I come home, and then I'm like, I'll just sign another year, though. You know, it's just another year.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I would, if you're going off of my advice, I would challenge most people to leave your hometown, because everything that you come to think and know and learn about during that time period, it completely changes when you go somewhere else. Like, I don't know. At least for me,
it's the best part of touring for me. It's the reason I have trouble when I come home. It's because when I get stationary and I stop being exposed to new stuff, I start to feel bad. I start to feel like I'm not doing anything. Like, I'm throwing time away that I'm not going to get back.
Yeah.
Funny how I don't think that way when I'm taking a nap, but when I, but well,
sleep is necessary.
Yeah, if I'm awake and I'm bored and I'm not, like, doing something constructive, I start to feel bad pretty quickly. It's so funny how much stuff I will create and work on, and that'll make me feel good. But then if I don't release it, I also feel bad. So since I haven't been releasing a lot of things, I've created so much stuff the last couple of years, but then due to this little mental block, I haven't released it. So it's like a twofold thing. It's not like it's not as simple as just being like, you just got to do stuff. It's like, you got to have a plan. You got to be excited about what you're doing, so you stay interested in it, which is probably why I just keep going on tour.
I think tour is great, but it's also, I think a lot of people look at it and go, man, that's so awesome. You must have, like, this great rock star life and you go to all these places. But everyone I've ever talked to tells me the same thing. They're like, dude, I went to Italy and played a show and then, like, left 12 hours later.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what it's like.
The thing for me is the community that it puts me in. I have not found a community at home. I never have. When I had a girlfriend for like 8 years, that was, you know, that's an obvious immediate community. But since then, which has pretty much been this whole last record cycle that I've been, on my own, that's like 3 years or something, I haven't found that community at home. When I go on tour, I'm going to find 10 people minimum that I'm like, I can't wait to hang out with this person every day. I think that's what keeps me addicted to it. But one thing that I've noticed as I get older, that it is really bad, is if you leave all the time, you are not building anything at home. So that's another reason I think you see a lot of guys that are like me stay on the road so much, is if you left too many times, it does get difficult to build I guess, to set roots up at home. It's pretty difficult when you leave all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's how it is. Like, to be able to travel like that and play the shows and be able to write the music and also play it. I mean, I could stop touring and I could sit at my house and write music all day, but would I get the same... with my personality, I don't think that's where I get the reward from. For me, it's the, I mean, I just got off of a tour. I got sent home early, but the last year, Miss May, has been off the road. Levi had a baby. The record cycle ended, and we were, for the first time in our whole career, we were like, we're just not going to go on tour for a minute. I didn't say that, but other people said that. And so I had to adjust, and my first thought was, I'm calling Pablo. So I called Pablo from Chelsea Grin, and I was like, well, we've always joked how cool it would be if I could branch out and start working for your band. And so I just started working for him. So I actually spent the first year that I had the opportunity to be off, I filled my time with working for another friend's band because I still like touring so much. I'm still so connected to touring, which was great. That's actually what I was doing up until last Sunday when the quarantine started.
Yeah, I remember you texted, or you, I don't know, you DM'd me or something, and you were like, what a great time for me to get into the
yeah, like I was just saying, like I haven't like branched out, or I hadn't branched out and like found like a second thing I was interested in. And I always love performing, and I always love being in the studio and live shows, but I like kind of was always overlooking what the other part of the band I enjoyed so much was, which was, I just like putting the actual show day together. I've always been interested in, when we were local, it was always a blast for me to network with people and try to figure out how we could put a show together, even if it was only like, you know, 30 miles away, all the way up until now where I'm obsessed with handling all the logistics for Miss May I, and I still do it. And I was like, I wonder if I would like being in charge of just making sure another band's day was cool. That's basically what the tour manager is doing. You're keeping the whole tour organized and making sure the band and all the dudes on the crew are having a good day. And then I did it once and I was like, oh yeah, I do like this. This is pretty cool too. So I dove in full time, and then I dove in during a pandemic. So bad timing, but obviously I couldn't have predicted that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, you know, maybe it's worth talking about how to sort of stay recession proof when things like this happen. So like for me, my businesses are all making more money because this happened.
Right.
Because everybody's sitting inside and they want something to do. So they're looking for new plugins. They want to watch, you know, learn stuff from courses, things like that. So I think there's a lot of musicians out there that put a lot of their chips in one basket. You know, it's sort of like, okay, we're going to make our money from touring, or we're going to make our money from merch. And it's like, well, you might not be able to sell merch or tour when things like this happen.
And I've been through that on multiple occasions through the roller coaster of being in a, you know, a large metalcore band. It's a pretty tumultuous career. And I stuck with this, like you said, a lot of people do. I stuck with the band only for up until last fall, really. I did not do anything else. I would ride the storm. If we had a bad record cycle or a bad year or something, I would have a bad year. And that was the whole plan behind starting that extra touring and starting to have another work outlet. Because I saw the other guys in my band doing it, and a lot of my friends doing it. I saw a lot of...
Yeah, but I think the point I'm making, though, is there's things that you can still do with the Miss AI brand to still make money during this time. And I think, obviously, that's a challenge. It takes a lot of... it's just challenging. Like, it's like, what do you do, you know? But I see... You know, you got people on Twitch, which is cool. Good example of that would be Ronnie Radke.
Heafy's is phenomenal too. Matt's is really, really good. Those two dudes particular have this. I have another friend. Do you know Saxel Rose yet?
Yeah.
Another gentleman I'm good buddies with who, you know, they're touring counterparts, and I've known all three of those guys, and it's cool to watch all three of them because they all have this trait that I struggle with. I can stand on a stage in front of, you could put me in front of 20,000 people. I would not give a shit. It would be fine. I'd be like, even better. You put me in front of a camera or one person and I shut down. And I've really enjoyed watching a few of the people I've kind of grown up with touring the last couple of years kind of branch out and show like that they've made a whole second career off of something that like I don't quite have the mindset for, like the Twitch and the streaming thing. That's always been something. I've always enjoyed having Levi Benton around because he can be the face and I can just hang back. And I always admire a musician who can be like, I'm just going to go ahead and take the bull by the horns here. I'm going to make my own lane that I'm completely self-sufficient in.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's everyone in the music. Well, I shouldn't say everyone in the music industry or music business, but I mean like all the artists in the music business, they really put everything, they put a lot of their focus around event-based revenue or event-based business. Like, okay, we have a VIP meet and greet. Okay, we have a tour. Yeah. Okay, we have a show. Yeah, it's like...
Yeah, that's like the blueprint that everybody's been following for so long, and it's really changing. It's really changing the last couple of years.
You got to make, like... I love the idea of a fan club. I haven't seen anyone really crush that yet other than, like, you know, super groups like Metallica and stuff.
Yeah,
but
the really big acts do a really great job. At a smaller level with less money, it is a little bit harder to... I shouldn't say less money, with less staff. With less staff when you're only like a, you know, a five-person group and keeping up on that.
But then you look at bands like Our Last Night.
Dude, geniuses.
Yeah, they come up with a completely different business.
And it's so funny because this is what I love to see is when you have, so everybody loves Our Last Night when the first two records come out. You remember the first two when we were recording together the first time? Every dude in a band was like, dude, this band is full of like 16-year-olds and they're so good. And the singer is literally a little kid and they're killing it. I toured with them in 2009 and it just didn't happen. Like, it didn't pick up for them, but everybody was on board. Then they started doing YouTube covers, and it's so funny because all these guys who weren't friends with them before immediately start talking shit, immediately start being like, oh, this is so stupid what they're doing. Look, they're just a cover band. Dude, they're bigger than all of us now.
And they're doing their own like headlines
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah. And they're still, and every time I see them, there's the exact same nice people as when I met them when we were all like teenagers. So
it's the entertainer. Like you think, okay, well, I'm an entertainer. I'm going to do things differently. I'm going to make my own original brand. I'm going to make my own original music and I'm going to go build my own fan base from scratch. Do you realize how monumentally hard and almost nearly
right.
impossible those three things are?
Yeah.
to
yeah.
Do?
I actually have experience and can confirm nearly impossible. Like I say it all the time. I don't think I could do what I've done again if I had to. Like the at least not in the exact same way. Like for the things to come together the way they have, and I feel like it's like that for most people. I can't, even though I walked the path, I can't see the path that I took because it's so complex and so long and so crazy. Like I know the general map, but so much stuff happens along the way that you, when you look back at it, you're like, I love when something happens and I'm like, I didn't even remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. My brother's calling me right now. Sorry, guys. Like I was talking to a guy yesterday and he reminded me, he read an article about a lyric writing process that we did on a record. I think it was the fourth one or something. And he was like, you guys did this. And I was like, oh my God, we did. We did do that. He was like, yeah, you use these topics from fans. And I was like, oh my God, how did I wrote the thing. How did I not remember that? But there's just so many details along the way. They just get kind of hazy. We made one of these a while back. It was over a year ago already in your house. And yeah, I drove all the way to Joey's house. Hung out for a day. It was really good.
The episode was awesome.
The audio is not very good. I talked since you were the first one. I talk over top of you. There's a lot of rustling. It was a good attempt. It's cool. It's fun for me to listen to. I think I'll cut it and send it to you just so that you can hear it because the stories are pretty funny. But
okay,
it's just not listenable thanks to my skill level at the time. But you know. Live and learn. That's how it goes. We were about to go on the Monument Tour, the 10-year anniversary of Monument was, I believe, what we were talking about. But we actually talked more about Apologies Are for the Week because since I wasn't there, I just got really interested in the story of how the record went down because I wasn't in the band at the time. And all my information was at the time, I can't even remember what video service it would have been, but it was a video service in 2008. And I was like streaming with BJ and he was at the studio with you when they would drive back and forth to high school from the studio to record the record, yeah. Which is nuts.
Dude, it was crazy times, man. Actually, it was posted on my Instagram. I don't know how far back that was now. I'm going to look it up real quick. But I posted a picture of hold on a second. I got to find this photo.
I don't know if I saw this. Great. I'll have to go look.
I'll send it to you. But man, so basically those times were crazy because they were all still in high school. They were still going to school. So they would come and record and then like we would stay up until like 3 a.m. They would take like an hour nap on my living room floor and then like get up and drive from Connersville, Indiana to back to Ohio and go to school like in that.
Yeah, that's some dedication. They've told me stories about about teachers like giving them breaks and stuff because they knew that the band had been signed and like they were driving in from the studio and it's crazy. I used to feel really, really regretful that I wasn't a part of that whole period. But as I've gotten older, I've realized like had I been a part of that period, who knows if the trajectory would have even been the same. Would I have made some negative impact because of an opinion I had on a song that changed a song and it wouldn't have been as popular, or would something have been cut that made the record, or blah blah blah, or it could have been better. I mean, I guess I could be a an optimist for once and say I could have added something to it, but I used to feel really bad about that. But as I got older, I think I kind of remembered like I got sent that record when it was done and it was really cool because I just wasn't in the band yet. So I was just like anybody who likes the band, I was listening to that record before it released the same way everybody else did. I just liked it. I just listened to it and I was like, this is so crazy. Sucks that I was in the band 9 months ago. And now you've made this like masterpiece that I'm not a part of, but I thought that was really interesting. It made the whole first record cycle exciting though. When I got the job back. And
did you feel like you had big shoes to fill?
I was 21. I couldn't tell you. I think I was probably just cocky and ready to go. I say cocky because when I left the band, they were all my best friends and I joined a touring opportunity with four people I didn't know. And I quickly realized that it had nothing to do with being signed and had nothing to do with just the act of being on tour. it had to be with the right people, because who the hell wants to live in a van with four people you don't like and play for, you know, 10 people and struggle like you have to do at the beginning of a career? I only lasted 9 months with that band. And then all of a sudden, this band who makes a record that was like, the record was amazing. And they asked me to come back. Like, they could have asked anybody at that point, and they flew me in. And the first tour was a real tour. They had a booking agent. Chris was managing them at the time. I was a massive Prada fan. So I know I was nervous, because I also had only sang like three syllables so far in my life on, like, in a studio, like one of those old school 2007 style metalcore parts where, like, you sing for literally 7 seconds. You don't really know why, but you did. And it doesn't repeat or anything. I had no experience, really. And then,
so you could get the,
girl, yeah, exactly. Show. Exactly. And, all of a sudden it was just like, you sing during, in, 6 of the 7 songs. So I do remember that part being difficult, and I remember being horrendous at it too, and learning the hard way that you used to have to learn, because even when we recorded the second record, when we were making the demos, I remember I don't know if you have this, but the Relentless Chaos demo is a MacBook on a chair outside of a door that's closed while we play out of full, as a full band, like with 2 4x12 cabs and an 810 cab at full volume and a drum set. That was our pre-pro back then. So the only way you could really get a lot of your practicing in, because the technology, I mean, you were the only guy I knew that had a home recording ability. You were way ahead of everyone, especially in our area. And that means if you wanted to learn how to sing, you just had to go fuck up in front of people. And be embarrassed about it, and then come back and be like, well, that was embarrassing enough that I'm going to try tomorrow to not do that again, because that was not great.
It's really interesting how many purposes it serves, because for me, it was just proof. I just needed proof that vocals were done. I got so sick of having bands come in and being like, yeah, 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 yeah. And then they come in and they're like, oh, no, all we have is this. Like, we have a 1 minute riff.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
vocals.
Yeah.
We have. So I'd be like, okay, well, if you want to book your dates, here's how that works. You don't get to pick a date on a calendar until you send me a file that shows me that you have vocals written. And I guess that was your guys' way of doing that, is you just did a MacBook recording of your practice. But that was great, because then I was like, okay,
yeah,
you guys are,
and I remember we were coming into our second record then, so I don't think you would have said no anyway, because we knew from working with you, or I didn't know yet, because I had only done like the local band stuff, but I remember the band being super confident, like, everything that's great that we're gonna write, we're gonna rewrite when we get there with him. Like, that's the way that it goes. And I'm just taking their word for it at that point, because I hadn't done a full length yet. I was just like, when I recorded with you the first time, it was over a weekend. We did 8 songs in 3 days, which is hilarious to think about. But we did 8 songs in 3 days. That was my only recording experience, whereas they had done the full length recording style, where I think you even sent them to do pre-pro. Chris helped them out with it. Like, I think they actually pre-pro'd Apologies. And then Monument, we were touring constantly. We literally came to the studio from the road and went to the road from the studio, if I remember correctly. It was just one big continuous chain of events.
Yeah, because I did a little bit of everything. Like, it was such a crazy time period, because it was almost like becoming a producer, but not really knowing what a producer did, but at the same time doing.
Yeah, for sure.
Does that make sense? Like, and so I was like totally unaware that there should be an engineer, and there should be a producer, and there should be a mixing guy, and there should be a mastering guy.
Yeah, I think the only help you had it all on Monument was, I think you would send drums or you would send guitars to Nick to edit. Even back then, and he would send them back over, because he sent us a guitar solo one time over one of our songs, And I remember us dying because he was so skilled at guitar.
Yeah, you guys were was, like, oh, shit.
Nick does our – Nick's done the last – he did Deathless when you two did it together. And then he did Shadows, and then he's doing our new one as well. So it's funny because besides you, I feel like technically we've worked with Nick because of you now longer than like anyone else in our career.
Yeah, Nick was a savior, man, and still is a good friend of mine, and also still a great engineer and producer. But back then, it was really just to say, like, we needed to save as much time as we could because there was just so many things happening.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about how much you were actually doing when I look back at it. There was no one else at the house.
Yeah, I was making 10 records a year, dude. And that's the records that I made.
Yeah.
There's also records.
So the you were working on, you had just finished Attack's second record when we got there. Smokahannas was going to be the first single, I think. And we had been touring with them a ton and we're really close with them. So that was exciting. You had just done a Plea for Purging record that we are huge fans of. I think that's what it was. But the big one you were doing right then was you were mixing the Zombie EP. So we would do Monument sessions and then you'd be like, all right, guys, you gotta find something to do for a bit. Yeah.
Yeah, go play.
Go
Xbox
watch that Nine Inch Nails DVD again. whatever it is you're gonna do. And so we would just go hang out and then you'd shut the doors to the studio room and you'd start mixing the Zombie EP. Which was really cool. And then we went on tour with them. That's what we went on tour. That we went immediately into that Devil Wears Prada tour that we did, like right after the studio. Which was,
it was a lot of fun, man. Although everything about that time period was just amazing. 2009 was sick for me. I know most of the world was like, "Oh my god, the economy is crashing," and I feel the
same way right now. Right now, so many people are panicking, and I'm stressed, of course, because the touring industry didn't shut down in 2009. Just economy issues. But when it all comes back around, and hopefully we are all released in June from home jail, I'm hoping that it's the same as it was in 2009, and the music world is where people are leaning to. I can't wait. Actually, I just am thinking about it right now. I can't wait to not be in my house and go outside with all my friends and go to. I'm supposed to go to the studio in June, so I'm looking ahead. Like, let's.
I really think that you're going to see a quicker turnaround on something like this, because this isn't the same as, you know, the crash in 2009, at least in terms of the economy, because what you're looking at there was sort of a failure of the system. I'm looking at the market right now. It's already pretty much recovered a lot. Like in the last couple of days, I mean, it's increased by 30% and it was down by 30% roughly. So it's really kind of bouncing back already, and so now the only concern is health and safety, and obviously we have a shortage of things that we need there all across the board. But I don't know, music and art and those things will never ever lose their value. They will always be something that people need, especially in a time of turmoil and things like this. Like, people, music helps people get through stuff. Music helps people communicate. We're pretty recession proof, whether it feels like it or not. You really are involved in a market that will never die, and that's pretty wild if you think about that. Because, you know, people need a lot of different stuff, but music is one of the things where, even if we're at the very bottom of the barrel and we're at war and everyone is not allowed to even open their doors and there's like bombs going off outside your house, like the only relief you're going to get is like maybe sitting down and listening to an album that night. You know what I mean? It's pretty crazy. So I don't know. Music is amazing.
I'm still, I still haven't found another thing. I haven't found anything that I enjoy as much as this. It's still the same way, but maybe one day I'll find another thing. I should probably learn how to cook. I was thinking about that. That's one thing this did to me is.
Dude, that is a really great, what do they call that? A horizontal or a, horizontal. You should do that because it's very similar to like working with music, like combining different notes and melodies and beats and things to make like a cool sounding song. It's kind of like combining different ingredients to make
a you really turned into quite the dish. Quite the chef. I posted a I didn't post a picture of your food, but I posted a picture from the time where we were living at your place and you were cooking. We would just band fund all the ingredients every day, or we would do like once a week because it was pretty labor intensive for you. So we ate a lot of we would do Mexican food once a week. You would cook steak once a week. I'm trying to think if we went anywhere else. We went to that crazy barbecue spot in, what was the little spot in Michigan we were in? Was it Manchester?
Oh, you're talking about B-52.
Yeah, we drove. Chelsea, we all went maybe? I drove us all there in the van. It was so much fun. That was such a cool time. That was a cool few weeks.
Yeah. I sent you a DM. I don't know if you're able to open that while we're on here, but you'll see a picture of Justin laying on the floor during the recording
period
we were talking about.
Is that from Monument or is that from Apologies?
I think that's from Apologies, honestly. It's a pretty long time ago. I went back through. I used to post everything on my MySpace. And I'm so glad I did that because looking back now, like, I don't even know how to turn those devices on anymore. Because I had like a flip cam.
Yeah, I've got a lot of dead devices too that I was actually really jealous when I was watching a few bands did a really great job of launching websites right when this pandemic started, where they found footage of their whole career and collected it all into one spot. And I was like, man, talk about organization to be able to keep up with the changing devices like that for years and years and have all that content still available. Because I mean, I've got iPhones that I know I can't get stuff off of already. Even if I turn the thing on, there's no way I know the passcode, or there's no way that I have a charger for it. Or that you,
it's getting worse over time. I'm not exactly sure how their infrastructure works. I'm talking about MySpace, but I went there like I don't know a year ago, and just I actually had my assistant at the time. I was like, go on here and do anything you can to get these photos to load. And then as soon as they load, like save them somewhere because this site is like completely destroyed. It doesn't work.
And is that your original account still? That's amazing.
Yeah, like you can go to it right now, myspace.com/Joey's Music. You can see all the crazy times with the us recording guitar with our shirts off and because the air conditioner broke and just all the
that's
things
so that wild in there. Yeah, MySpace was huge. I was talking to a gentleman on a podcast yesterday about I think he asked like what I thought the single most important thing that made the difference for our age group, for the group before us, for metalcore to blow up. MySpace. I said MySpace. First the metalcore bands made the bands one generation before us started the trend and made the momentum. They kind of opened the door. And I'm talking like before Protest. It'd be like God Forbid, Darkest Hour. They started it and then they were touring and they were killing it. They're doing like Ozfest. And all of a sudden, there's a whole new young generation that gets handed MySpace when they're making their first music. And then you see this explosion of the entire genre. And then you and I were along for the metalcore ride of like the real crazy. I mean, it's huge now. I was just on a tour watching like 1,000 people sing metalcore songs in 2020. And that's crazy. You know what I mean? That's crazy to see that many people coming to this, like, what was in 2006 a relatively unknown, except for the core fan base of metalcore, like a genre that was completely unknown. And now we're like 15, 20 years in, or 20 years later, and it's, you know, still selling. Or like, you got a friend like Ronnie. We're talking even more than that. We're talking a band like that that's crossed pop and metalcore together. And I mean, that's a like 2,500 person a night band now, which is crazy. To come from you and I remember your first local. Yeah. That's another thing that people don't realize is I also remember, I've known you long enough that I remember your first local band. I remember when you were like a musician, not just the guy who recorded everything. Yeah.
Corla?
Yeah. And that was like, that stage of that genre was literally, you had to put your own shows together wherever you could do them. Gymnasium, living room. And then every once in a while, there'd be a band big enough that would come through that would play like a real venue. Like Bury Your Dead would come through or something, and they'd play like a 200 cap club. You'd be like, oh my God, this is it. Dude. And you'd sell tickets to open up for the not sold out 200 cap club.
Miss May I was like,
yeah, that was the network. For me, I've never been our songwriter. I really love performing, and I love learning songs, and I've just never been a great songwriter. My interest from day one was the networking and touring end. And that's what MySpace was for us. It was like reach out to Coraline because they're in Indiana, reach out to IC Stars because they're in Michigan, reach out to Gwen Stacy because they're in Indiana, blah, blah, blah. Just keep finding friends in different cities that are in bands that are cool and trade each other shows, and then go to the real venue and convince the owner of the real venue, like, I know you're paying these bands that are professional, that don't sell tickets. We're a local band. Put us on the show for free. Stop making us sell tickets. We'll sell enough tickets that you can pay the touring act and more people will be here and we get the exposure. And that's one of the reasons that we were getting ahead in Ohio back in the day, because I think that's that brashness that you have when you're young. I was just stepping around people like, no, we're not waiting. Like, I have a good idea and we have a good band here. So like, put us in front of the people. Don't put them in front of the people. Yeah, that was what we were known for sure, was being one of the ones that would travel and open for anybody and sell to that. Thank God for the Attic, that venue that was open in Dayton back in the day. That's the one that really did that for us all the time. Would let us open for Prada. We got to open for Job for a Cowboy. We got to open for Born of Osiris, which is a great one, because that's one that like we can tour with to this day. And we, you know, we were given 50 tickets. They're like, you don't have to buy them, but here's 50 tickets. Get 50 of your friends to come. Give us the tickets that you don't sell back. We just gave them all the tickets. We were like, 100 people are going to come because we're playing. We're not selling the tickets. And then 100 people came, and then they never asked us to sell tickets again.
It's amazing what you guys were able to do back then. And so for me, like, I was just focused on sort of the music, the sound, and like getting really competitive with the production side of things.
Yeah. What's crazy is after people started working with you, there was a new definition for what people wanted out of a producer. Like you redefined what people were looking for the following generation of producers that were coming through. Like, no longer were bands going to ask for three people. They're like, I remember that being a big deal. I remember when we were talking about Deathless, you were like, dude, I'm busy. I don't know if I can cram this in. You were trying to fit us in. You were trying to fit Asking in. And you were like, I don't have time to do this whole record. And we were like, we don't care if you track the record. We were like, but we want that same thing that we had in 2009 and 2010. We want it to just be you and the five of us. And then we, on that one, Nick engineered it and then retracted everything after we wrote it with you. But that, I remember that was the plan. That's how we made it work, was because you were going to do the whole record first, but you didn't have time. But because you made this new definition for like the most enjoyable way and most productive way to do a record, we were like, well, what if we just do the record once at your house and then we go do the whole thing again with Nick, just so that we can do it the way that we learned how to do it from you, like where we can do it the one-on-one way with you and write all the songs like that. And we've tried to do that.
Yeah.
Throughout our whole career with multiple producers now. It's worked a few times. It hasn't worked a few times. And I think that's probably a good reason we ended up working so well with Nick, is because he, you know, he pretty much worked underneath and with you as he was learning too. So it's kind of similar. Actually, it's an extremely similar process to the way we've always done it with you.
There's a lot of parts of making a record that are time consuming, and frankly, it just doesn't make sense to put, it's kind of like saying, okay, you know, let's go get, let's try to think of like a really good analogy. Like, let's go get Gordon Ramsay, who is like one of the best chefs in the world and can make like the most amazing food, but let's have him just make bologna sandwiches right now. Like, it doesn't make sense to have your all-star producer recording like every single note when the notes are just going to be like, whether it was me or somebody else pressing the record button, it's like paying a premium for something you don't need. Here's a better example. It's like driving a Lamborghini down your driveway. You can walk down your driveway, you could ride a bike down the driveway, or you could drive your Lamborghini down the driveway. But what is the most efficient, cost-effective way of doing that, right? Like, so that's what basically what it all ended up blossoming into was, use me for the parts where I'm necessary, and then for the other parts that could be done by, and I'm not trying to compare myself to everyone else and say like, oh, well, I'm like the most.
Yeah, that's just the workflow that you figured out is efficient and works.
It's more about creative brain power is what I'm trying to say. Like, if you want me to be really creative, take me away from all of the tedious tasks that will diminish or decrease my creativity. And that's where I think we really unlocked an amazing secret to creating albums. And it's one of the things now that, like, a lot of people ask me, like, Joey, how come you're not like making records all the time? It's like, well, it's true. I'm not making as many records as I used to, but when I make records now, first of all, I'm really happy because I'm not doing all the things that.
Yeah, you were really sticking your neck out there with some you had to put yourself in some, like in some uncomfortable positions to make those records happen. I remember asking you when we were hanging out at your house, and you said that when you moved into the cabin, it was the first time that you had actually lived by yourself for a period of more than 2 months without a group of five people you hadn't met yet coming in to live at your house.
Yeah. Like, imagine that your whole life is built around developing a new relationship.
With five once a month, 10 months a year.
It's like being on the set of Real World. Like,
and I don't think people realize at the beginning there, we're talking a 3-bedroom ranch house, 2 of the 3 bedrooms or a 4-bedroom ranch house. 1 bedroom was your parents when we were there the first time for Monument. 1 bedroom was you and your, and there were 2 bedrooms at the back of the house that were band rooms, a communal kitchen, a communal dining room in the studio. So you had no space. Like, you had no personal, there wasn't a room in your house besides your bedroom that wasn't shared with every person around, which is so crazy to me. Cause I mean, what age did you stop that at? How old were you when you moved into the cabin finally? This would have been after the mansion, after you tried that.
Oh, yeah. So that would have been, I moved to Michigan in 2011, and then we moved around a bit. So we lived, let's see, we lived in the mansion.
I think that's the only place that I never saw of yours. I don't think we made it up there during that period. I remember Jesse from it. Did you do an Amir record there? I feel like I remember Jesse telling me he recorded there.
Oh, yes. Yes. But that was, that was also a weird time period where we found, we were doing a lot of stuff, man. Cause then I had bands staying in the house and I had bands in hotels at the same time. So that's where they were at the hotel.
So were you doing two projects at once then?
Three actually. Cause I would have Attila downstairs. I'd have.
I forgot. They really took off right after they started recording with you too.
Attila downstairs, Famous Last Words upstairs, and then Icy Stars coming in and out whenever they felt like it, and then doing Crown the Empire and Amir at the same time, but then Crown the Empire decided to go with Dan Cornett, so then I never got to that point where I was doing four bands at the same time, but I tried to.
Do you think that was difficult for your brain power in regards to, like, I brought this up when we're writing our new record. I've made a big push for key changes and tuning changes. Not drastic, but just slightly different to step out of the same box after six records. Were you feeling like a little fatigued during that time because you've got four bands that are semi-metalcore trying to do the same thing at the same time, and they're like, Joey, we're here because you're supposed to put the sparkle on top of this that makes us defeat these other three bands.
I mean, it's kind of like a weird, like, bell curve kind of thing, where at the peak of my creativity and the peak of, like, sort of, I would say, my sound's popularity was when this transition started to happen. And so I do think a little bit suffered when I had to make sacrifices. I had to be like not the guy to do every single edit and not the guy to like sit down with the band. Cause I think something happens for sure. When you sit down with a band for 12 hours a day, every single day, or like 14 hours a day, every single day, that's different than being checking in like a few hours a day or 1 hour a day.
Absolutely.
Or even a couple times a week. Right. Like, it's a big difference. So, but at the same time, what I'm gaining is way more creativity headspace, like being able to use my brain. But then all that extra creativity headspace kind of just went into, okay, well, now I can do more projects at the same time. So it was a really weird curve. But I still think all of the work that came out of
it. Yeah, I don't think anybody's amazing. Arguing like, that.
You can go, this is the thing that makes, and this is kind of the little bit of, I don't know, like, I kind of giggle a little bit when I go and look up all these bands that have carried on and worked with lots of different producers after me. And I go look at their Spotify profiles, and like still two or three of their most popular songs to this day are the ones that
we're
did
like
with
that.
The band.
We're like that. And you know what that says?
And I'm not trying
this
to be
is
like
something that as a, I almost called myself an aging musician. That sounds terrible. As I get further along, I have an appreciation for that now, because what that says to me is that what we created in that moment is standing the test of time, which is the entire purpose of having the producer. If you just wanted to make whatever the hell you wanted and you didn't care about if people were going to enjoy it for an extended length of time, everybody would make their own shit in their bedroom and no one would care. And everybody would be like, my ideas are the best. I don't ask anybody else. But when you go and you link up with a producer and then you become friends with them like we did, that's what you want. You're like, because not only do you identify with the song because it's your song, as the time goes by, I notice myself looking back on the time and I'm like, if you see that song, it's still popular. Like, I played a show in December. We did the Monument 10-year anniversary, and I was I used to say, I was like, man, when we get to that point where we got to do a 10-year anniversary tour, we're going to be shot. And I couldn't see what that 10-year anniversary tour actually meant before I had something that was 10 years old. And then when we did the tour, I was like, these are so much more special to me now because they're 10 years old and people still like them. That says to me that we did an awesome job together. And it took until the last record for us to release anything that kept up on Spotify. So, I mean, that's saying something. It's not, we're not tone deaf to the fans either. I know a lot of fans out there think that like bands, when they're trying to do different stuff, they're just not listening. Like we're all listening. You just can't do the same thing over and over. It'll drive you insane. So like we had great success with one big single on the record after Monument, but nothing else on the record hit. Didn't really have any success on the record after that. Deathless was too short. The only reason Deathless ended up being so short is it's more of a business deal. We signed to a different label and decided to go forward on the following record with a different label. And, you know, the label is not going to keep pumping money into an artist and release that isn't coming back. So we knew that we couldn't tour that record long enough. So it didn't get the opportunity. So it took four more records for us to have something that could even to have a record that had more than one song on it that could even keep up with those ones from 2010. And there's so many bands like that from that era. It's cool. I used to be offended by that, and now I'm just flattered by it. Now I'm like, I think I'd probably be offended if nobody was coming to the shows anymore. You know. Then I'd be a little worried. I'd be like, damn, okay.
It's kind of weird because I don't know if this is really, this is sort of my assessment of the situation, but I don't know. Maybe I was like the people's producer because I see bands now going to bigger producers and nothing against those guys. I mean, they're fucking amazing and talented at what they do, but it's like they take the band into the studio and they're like, let's use a hit formula and like let's do all this stuff, and it sounds like this kind of radio rock thing, and that works definitely for some people, and I've seen it happen to some of the bands that I've worked with. But I was always just sort of like, let's like take your ideas and put and make like a comic book version, I mean like a superhero version is what I'm trying to say. Like let's make the superhero version of what you're trying to do right now. And it worked. Like I think people.
It really is like a jacked up steroids version. It's so funny that you say it that way because that's how you feel when you bring a song in and you record it. Is if you wrote the song and you recorded it before you went to the studio and you bring it in and you've been listening to it for 2 months and you're like, this is how it sounds. It's pretty good. It's gonna sound 10 times better. Like it's gonna be a jacked up superhero version of that same song. That's when you know you didn't do a great job at the end of a recording, is when you finish a session and you go back to listen to your song you wrote and it's done and you're like, oh, it's not, like you just know, you're like, it's not there. And that was never, there's not a, it's so funny, when we did the Monument 10 year, I thought that I was going to go back and I was going to be like, these are so dated. And they're not good. Dude, they were so good. Like, the songs are so good. Then we had so – the new record is so much – is probably going to be so much more similar to that songwriting style, because when we played those songs again, we were all like, oh, yeah, I totally remember why we wrote this all the time. Like, this style is very fun for us, so – And again, a lot of that came out of the fact that we worked with you, because it didn't sound like that before we got to you. And then we made a superhero of a record. You've made a lot of my favorite records. I think since I'm 31, I think I'm in that age group that was like, you were the people's champ of producers. So you were dropping a lot of records at that time that were my favorite records too. Kind of a cool thing to be in metalcore and touring when it was my favorite kind of music too. So that was cool. Lucky break to like be in metalcore and be recording with you at the same time. And then I'm becoming friends with all these other bands that are recording with you. And that Speaker of the Dead album is probably going to be one of my all-time ones. That's a cool, the Zombie EP, because those are two examples of I'm at the studio with you or I'm hanging out with you and we get the opportunity in between your crazy life and our crazy life back then. And you're like, oh, I made this with these. And then I end up going on tour with that band. So not only do I hear you like recording it, like the Zombie EP, but then I end up on tour with that band. And now they're playing those songs right in front of me too, which was a super exciting time. I remember that when we got Warped Tour finally was a huge deal. That was like in 2011, that was the moment. That's when you knew. Because I remember when Prada got it the first time, everybody was like, there they go. I remember when we got it. And it's so funny because like five of the eight bands on our stage were Sturgis fans. Yeah. Like the five of the most popular records on the tour at the time were all your records, which was so funny.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's a perfect storm of a lot of things. You guys, well, first of all, let's, you know,
yeah, you
got Rise Records.
Craig Erickson, man.
Craig Erickson. So Craig Erickson becoming a great businessman, Rise Records becoming a great record label, and then bands like you from Ohio, like learning the sort of the grassroots underground game, taking control of that and basically innovating in that game. Like I really think the show swap thing was genius. And then you have me sort of like playing around with computers to try and like innovate the production game. So all those things happening at the same time. And then the
business end stepped in too. These are names that like people that listeners probably wouldn't know, but then you have people that like Dave Shapiro who stepped in, who was booking all these bands. And before the tour, you know, the tours probably weren't a few years before that when I was going to concerts, the tours didn't make a goddamn bit of sense. Like I remember seeing a tour that was like August Burns Red from a second story window, Life in Your Way. I mean, just like all over the place, all these crazy bills of different types of metal, and the metal scenes were not like coming together. And then all of a sudden you get these people like Dave Shapiro and Craig at Rise, and they're like, no, we have found five of the same type of band. And then all of a sudden you start seeing these crazy tours in like 2008, 2009, when like all of a sudden it's like Prada and A Day to Remember are teamed up and they're bringing 1500 people in. And then Attack does a record with you and Breaks, and they're like, we're gonna bring Miss May I and Our Last Night. And then Amur starts tapping bands like us, and then all of a sudden the booking agents like Dave are like, well, you should meet Whitechapel, you should meet After the Burial, you should meet, and then all of us, that's the kind of stuff that nobody really sees, and it's all these like the behind the scenes stuff. But those like networking opportunities and introductions that people like Craig and Dave made for us back in the day, and Chris Ruby, I always got to say Chris Ruby, because he actually introduced the band to all of those. He probably introduced the band to you, probably introduced the band to Rise, and he probably introduced the band to their booking agent at the time. So that's another crazy thing, is we were lucky to be in Dayton, and one of the guys became friends with Chris from Prada, which was another crazy break that's overlooked and not talked about enough, but he's a super important person.
I mean,
for our career too.
Chris was actually that's a really I like that we're bringing this up, because I don't think I've ever gotten a chance to ever say this anywhere. Chris was like important for so many reasons, like even beyond the stuff you just mentioned. Like I remember sitting down in the, you know, at the computer recording like guitar riffs or like recording, you know, different parts of their songs. And Chris always was sort of like the, the creative leader of the Devil Wears Prada. I mean, aside from like
the lyricist and
being the lyricist and being very poetic and having an idea of what he wanted the songs to feel like and what he wanted them to do. But Chris was like more of a, I don't know. I just learned a lot from him, to be honest with you. And when I get on like podcasts or things, I always say like, you know, sometimes I get asked the question about what it's like to work with so many different artists. It's like, well, one of the benefits was learning so much from each individual person. It was like each time, you know, I've got 5 new people in my house for a month and I learned something from each person that month. But Chris was one where I really learned how to be better. I learned how to set the bar higher. I learned how to, he challenged me in a lot of ways. You know, it was like, he's like, this is what we want to do. And then he would be like, figure it out. Not in a mean way or anything, but it was
he knew that like, he was ready to put the work in. He knew if he could like tell you what his idea was, that if there was anybody that was going to figure it out, you would be the guy, and you would make it happen. Yeah. He's the same way for us.
And so I don't get to talk to Chris enough. I really want to reconnect with him, but if you're listening to this podcast, Chris, reach out to me, buddy. But what an amazing guy. And the Devil Wears Prada like kind of paved the way absolutely. A little bit for some of this.
You can't even put a measurement on how huge they were to Dayton. It is so crazy how huge they were for Dayton, because they even brought along some bands that inspired us that just didn't quite have the success that we were just massive fans of. So you did the one that we will say until we break up, we'll call out that At the Throne of Judgment record for years. I mean, that was one, that's another one that Chris brought along. I'm pretty sure like he became friends with them and brought them along. And, you did an Every Bridge Burned record, I'm pretty sure. That was another Ohio one. Like, Dayton and Ohio in general just had a lot going on. I don't know why that happened, but once Prada hit, it really helped the rest of us, that's for sure. We definitely all got more attention. Like Rise Records, a record label in Portland, Oregon, is signing 3 metalcore bands out of Dayton, Ohio. Like, that's insane. How did that even happen? And that's probably all we could probably give Chris credit for, all 3 of those, I would say, which is nuts. And another thing, that all happened while I was gone too. So I left the band. We had a 3-song EP and we were just a local band. And then while I'm gone, not only do they get signed, but they got signed by my favorite label. They confirmed the record with you, and then they ended up getting managed by the damn guitar player of my favorite band. And I was just like, I really fucked up here, guys. Like, my plan, I thought it was good. Turns out it was not. So I still feel real lucky that I got my spot back. All right. Well, we'll call it here. We're at like hour and 15 minutes. Thanks for spending your quarantine boredom with me for a few hours.
Hey man, anytime.
Yeah, we'll have to dive into some more specific stories. Yeah, thanks again, man. I hope to see you in person soon. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, as soon as we can stand next to each other without
giving each other some kind of fucking virus, then let's do it. All right, buddy. Nice talking to you. All right.